This is Cyber Defense Radio with your host and cybersecurity expert, Gary Malefsky. Gary brings to you another globally recognized cybersecurity executive in the hot seat today.
Sitting in my hot seat today is an executive. He is a CISO. These are great interviews. People like Robert Fernandez, who's the Chief Information Security Officer of the Investment Center, found online at investmentctr.com, is also a virtual CISO consultant. He's been a speaker at TEDx conferences, keynote at industry conferences, a moderator. He's really an expert at cybersecurity. So, Robert, we're really lucky to have you today in the hot seat.
Yeah, it's great to be here, Gary.
So you and I were talking earlier about cyber. Is it technical? Is it, you know, business? How does one get promoted into the role of a CISO? And what should they be focused on in terms of communications with the board and also the cyber threats that are profound lately?
Yeah, great question. So I would say that everybody's path to become a CISO is probably very unique. Mine is as well. I came up from a tech background. So I, worked on programming. I was programming Java back in the day. I didn't like it at all. I was into some networking as well as some help desk and things like that. Done sysadmin things, kind of wore a lot of hats over the years. And I came from a perspective that people that were in the industry prior to me who have been in the tech industry much longer than I was, I had this assumption that they understood security very well, so that if I would ask a service provider or a technician to implement something for me or to put something in place, some software, some server, I just assumed that they knew what they were doing from a security perspective and they were doing it in a secure manner. Well, I found out that wasn't true over the years, and I started questioning a lot of the things that they were doing, and it led me down a rabbit hole where I got really into security, and I started kind of teaching myself security, learning security on my own. Found out that I was really good at it, and I think it comes, from wearing those lots of hats, moving up the ranks to where I was and where I am now. But it was a path for me, and I find that the background in tech really helps me to be good at what I do. Because one of the things that I tell people quite often is that one of the most important things that you have to do if you're a CISO is you have to be a good translator. And what I mean by that is that whether I'm speaking to somebody in operations or a receptionist, and I want to tell them about our security policies and procedures and different things that, a lot of end users might seem to feel are, cumbersome or time consuming, or they're inhibiting their ability to be productive. And I like to work with those people and educate them properly and teach them and show them why we're doing it, as opposed to just saying, you have to do as you're told or else, right? I find that approach never works. And then the same way, going into a server room and speaking to a network administrator, or going into a boardroom and speaking to an executive or CEO, and I find that that's really, you have to be able to speak your skill set, which is not only cybersecurity, but it's business risk management, which I'll get to in a second. But you have to be able to speak that to whoever your audience is, whether it's the end user or the technical people, or whether it's, the CEO or the board or anybody like that. And I find that that's really important, to be able to communicate in their terms so they can understand what you're talking about. So you're not just throwing all of our, crazy tech and cybersecurity acronyms at them, like we love to use so many of them. So with that being said, I do think that one of the biggest misconceptions about cybersecurity is that it belongs in the server room, or it belongs in a technical silo with the tech people and everything like that. And I can't stress how much further that is from the truth. And I think that it's understandable why a lot of organizations think like that, because cybersecurity, as opposed to like technology, having a your first, you know, mail server sitting in a closet somewhere back in the day. You know, you have a technician come in that's able to support it and manage it. And then we started growing and, you know, now you have more servers and more workstations and all these things going on. You know, and you're asking, you know, your technical provider, hey, are these things secure? And then you start hearing more and more about data breaches and things like that. Right. So it's natural that the business owner go to the IT director or somebody in the IT department and start asking them questions about security. And they feel like they have an obligation to know the answers, but a lot of them really don't know the answers because they don't have the security background, which is far more broad than just technology, right? So they might understand, you know, the back in the day, the antiviruses, or today the EDRs or the MDRs or things like that. You know, so they might really understand those things and how to implement them properly, but I don't think they understand how to manage and even assess business risk and come up with the right approach, you know, holistically for the organization. So, you know, I like to try to squash that misconception that it's a technical problem. And I think it's more a business risk management issue that we need to be concerned about. And I think that, you know, it's clear to most people who are in the industry that the CISO's role should be, you know, in a boardroom or in an executive level where, you know, you're looking at business risk holistically and trying to manage that business risk.
That's great. So, for example, if we're quantifying our business risk today in our organization and we feel we have $20 million at risk, if there's a breach and there's some high-risk employees that are still being trained on anti-phishing and other things, and we only have a $10 million policy, we've got to get that risk down below the $10 million. So focusing on the business risk, doesn't that make us more of a bottom line profit center, not a cost center?
Yeah, I would say so, especially this day and age where, you know, if cybersecurity is done right, it could definitely be a profit center. And what I mean by that is that just like I mentioned about having a silo where, you know, people look at the technology silo as a security thing, I think we need to break down all of those silos and we need to bring all the departments onto our team. So I think having a, you know, a cybersecurity steering committee with leaders from each department is an important thing to a task to accomplish if you're going to be a CISO, and bring everybody on board and make sure everybody's on the same page. But going back to, you know, the different departments, I think the marketing department is perfect for that because nowadays when you see so much about data breaches and the cost of data breaches and things like that, you know, you are getting more clients that are sending out security questionnaires to different firms before they even work with them. So that definitely is a selling point. And, you know, I mean, why would it be any different than any other selling point if you invest in, you know, a new phone system or if you invest in, you know, new computers for your network or a new network? You know, any investment is going to cost you, but it's also going to bring you in money in the long run, right? So I think you need to look at cybersecurity the same way. And if you approach it that way, you can make it a profit center.
That's great advice. And having the steering committee and getting other groups involved, just folks who don't really understand cyber, but they understand business risk. If the lights go out or the manufacturing gear can't manufacture the soda, then Coca-Cola would be in big trouble, you know. So there's so many issues to all different verticals, but it all comes down to, I think, cyber resiliency, wouldn't you say? Nobody's really secure, are they anymore?
Yeah, I know. You can't guarantee that anything is going to be secure. And resiliency is definitely a huge part of it. I recently spoke at the Disaster Recovery Journal conference, and I keynoted that. And I spoke about Stealer logs and Stealer malware. And I brought it up from the perspective, again, being able to translate and speak to your audience. So mind you, I was speaking to DR, disaster recovery business continuity people. And even they were telling me that there's a lot of silos from the security that like one hand doesn't see what the other is doing all the time. So, you know, I spoke to them about how, you know, if you're looking in the dark web and you're looking in the paste bins and you're looking at the, you know, using OSINT, open source intelligence to, you know, go out there and proactively look for information that's out there about your organization. Sometimes you can sort of, you know, preemptively, you know, stop something from happening ahead of time. There was a case of an incident that happened with a company called Orange Spain. And they're, I believe they're a telecom provider. And what happened with them is they had an outage of that scanned across 50% of their network. Wow. And it was all because of one of their admin users was infected with Stealer malware. And for those of you that don't know what Stealer malware is, Stealer malware goes in and it does exactly what it's called. It steals information from the user's computer, from the victim's computer. But what it steals is it steals your internet history, your browser history. It steals your autofill. So whatever you have saved into your autofill, whether it's your name, your address, your phone number, sometimes even your credit card number, it'll steal those all unencrypted, clear text. It'll steal your saved stored passwords if you're storing them in the browsers like Chrome, Edge, Firefox, all clear text as well, which is why you never want to store them in the browsers. You always want to use something like a Bitwarden or something, some sort of a password manager. But it also steals your browser fingerprints and your computer fingerprint, and it steals your cookies, including persistent cookies. So if you have a persistent cookie that's active, let's say for 30 days, that's persistent, a threat actor can take all of that information that I just mentioned, and from their device, they can log in using that persistent cookie as you, which even can potentially bypass MFA in some cases. So it's really a scary thing. And I think we're starting to see a lot more of the Stealer malware because of remote workforces. Unfortunately, organizations are not properly protecting devices on a lot of these remote workers, especially when they're sometimes contractors in other countries that are developers and things like that.
So what you've talked about with Stealer malware is pretty scary. Is this something that is easily detectable with current EDR solutions, XDR, MDR? And are the bad guys polymorphing Stealer to make it, you know, 0 day and hard to detect?
Yes, definitely. The interesting things about the Stealer malware, the logs, and I've gone through a lot of them, and there's also a company called Flare.io that did a whole study on the Stealer malware logs, and they came up with all this information. If you wanted to read it, you can go to their site. But basically, one of the funny things that I find about it is it takes a screenshot right at the initial point of infection, which is often telling because it could show you a few different things. One of the things that I see a lot is that I can see where it's coming from. And a lot of it is from these developers that are from foreign countries that are downloading bootleg pirated software. And my guess is that they're downloading this pirated software to test some of the stuff that they're developing for the companies that are hiring them, things like that. But because you could see it, and you could see like the Pirate Bay sort of BitTorrent site that's open. And that's, you know, one of the things I see quite often on these screenshots. So it makes me really think about how many of these, Stealer malware infections are because of the outsourcing of, you know, development and, you know, technical, you know, capabilities that, you know, companies are just trying to cut costs, which brings me back to the important discussion that we had earlier about talking about, you know, business risk, right? And yes, businesses want to, you know, save money here and they want to save money there, but it's important to understand some of the risks of doing that, and outsourcing to some of these developers in foreign countries is one of those risks, right? So it's important to understand that this is a potential vulnerability that could leave an organization exposed by outsourcing, especially if you're not managing those devices. But as far as managing the devices, yes, EDR tools will usually be able to protect against it. But I have also seen screenshots where Windows Defender was actually up in the screenshot saying that something was detected and blocked. But obviously the malware still went through because I was looking at the logs from that malware. So we know nothing is perfect, right? I think moving toward a zero trust approach with most of the things that we do nowadays is really the way to go. So for any organization that's just starting out and they're building up a network from scratch, definitely build it with zero trust in mind. And for the more mature organizations, I think you just have to kind of take baby steps and work toward zero trust little by little to kind of get there one day.
Robert, is micro-segmentation part of zero trust, or it augments it really well?
Yeah, it's definitely part of it. It's the micro-segmentation. So, you know, historically, we've always created the perimeter, and then, you know, we've sort of trusted the inside of that perimeter and then not trusted what was outside of that perimeter. So we had the firewalls and, you know, egress and ingress, and we would, you know, block certain things from coming in. You know, but there was a lot of open, like, where we would allow things to go out quite often, right? And as we know now is that, you know, a lot of threat actors are, you know, reaching out and once they get in, then they're communicating outward, right? So it's going out to command and control sites and things like that. So it's important not only to block, you know, incoming traffic, but outgoing traffic as well, using whitelists and things like that. But also a big component of zero trust is, instead of building that perimeter from the outside in, we're working from the inside out. And we're starting with, you know, doing an asset inventory, identifying our crown jewels, and then protecting each one of them individually, not as a whole with that big perimeter, but instead having a lot of mini perimeters around those micro segments, and protecting them that way. And then also, instead of using sort of a role-based access where we're just making sure that the user is who they say they are, we're using that, but we're also using different behavior analytics and things like that. So, you know, is there impossible travel? Is it, you know, is this person logging in from, you know, Boston and Spain at the same time? Things like that. Did the firewall just recently get disabled since the last time that they were allowed access? So it's looking at a lot of different different perspectives and looking at different controls that were in place and allowing access based on those controls. And if it notices that maybe the firewall was recently disabled during an active session, it can automatically, you know, bump that person off of that active session.
Great advice. And, you know, I was just thinking about SaaS and so many SaaS solutions, so much software in the cloud that we all use every day. Some of them, it's beneficial where you can log in from multiple locations, but not at the same time, yet they let you, because they don't really, they never had cybersecurity developers. They're just developing cool software that does something like a Salesforce tool. And you would think it would boot out, you know, one person or warn you, hey, somebody else is trying to log in to your account from somewhere else. But most software I've used that's cloud-based doesn't even have that basic fundamental.
Agreed. Yeah. And that's why I think it's important to put a gateway in front of it, or a gateway service, you know, something like a single sign-on, for example, like Okta, for example. If you were to, you know, implement something like that, you can you know, fine tune the security controls around that to look for those exact things and kick somebody out or, you know, boot accounts, you know, and obviously it's important because through a single sign-on, you have access to multiple applications and sites and services. So it's really important to make sure, you know, a lot of end users like single sign-on for the convenience. I like it a lot for the analytics and for the security controls that you could put in place in front of your cloud SaaS services.
And, you know, there's simple things, like you said, whitelist. There's IP geolocation companies that know every IP address in the world, and they license that to banks so that, you know, when users are logging in, they're sure, are you really traveling to Japan today? And things like that. Just base, it sounds like it's fundamental and foundational things that are missing is why we get breached all the time.
Yeah. And as a matter of fact, I just had a little conversation about that on LinkedIn about the, you know, just doing the basics, right? And while I agree that that's absolutely true, I think it's important for most people to really understand, though, that the basics are constantly changing, which I think that's what makes it a little more complex for the non-technical people, right, to really understand. You know, if you go back years, you know, a 6-character password was acceptable, 8-character password. Then NIST came up with all different standards about eliminating the special characters and things like that. I always recommend, you know, 20 plus, 26 plus characters, but make it a passphrase. Use spaces in it if the site allows you to do it. But more importantly, I'm only remembering one passphrase, which might be a sentence or a phrase from a song. And, you know, and I'm using that to log in, obviously, along with my FIDO token to get into my password manager. And then all my passwords for all my sites, I have no clue what they are because it's creating it for me. So they're super complex passwords. And, you know, I just don't know what they are. MFA enabled right now is obviously one of the quote unquote basics. you know, but they are always changing. You know, we talked about the perimeter a few minutes ago, and I think that it's, you know, going to zero trust. I think will zero trust one day be the basics that we need to have a zero trust architecture in place? So that's always sort of a sliding, you know, a sliding bar. We kind of have to figure out where we are. And I do think zero trust is going to get us to a better place, because it's not going to solve all of our problems. Nothing will. But I do think that it'll definitely help limit the exposure of a data breach.
That makes so much sense. Now, speaking of data breaches, we've got billions of records on the dark web. We've got 500,000 and growing job openings in cybersecurity in the U.S. Our media group has a scholarship for young women in cyberware, trying to help out where and when we can. You started a nonprofit called Cyber Chance to help fill the gap. Can you tell us a little bit about this and where people can go to learn more?
Yeah, so cyberchance.org is the website. And yeah, I started Cyber Chance because, yes, there is a skills gap. And I find that a lot of people from inner cities are often underrepresented. And I sort of have experience. I grew up in an inner city. I know that, you know, you feel like the resources to you are very limited. You feel like your opportunities are very limited. And sometimes you don't have the confidence or the knowledge to understand what your skill set actually might bring you. And I do think that a lot of people in inner cities that went through some tough times, or that are, that, you know, live just in sort of like the, a little bit of a rough environment, I think that they have sort of a step up when it comes to cybersecurity. I mean, how many times has any of us been at a conference and we hear a CISO on stage, or we hear some other presenter on stage talking about, hey, if you want to beat these bad guys, you got to be able to think like a criminal. Well, that's, you know, in the inner city, that's sort of, you know, it's that situational awareness. It's kind of a norm there. So if you can provide a lot of these people with the right mentorship, the right guidance, good role models, and show them that they can take these skills that they have, that they've learned from, you know, street smarts that they learned on the street, and translate that into a cybersecurity world, it's a win-win for everybody, because we're keeping crime off the streets. And then we're also helping people get, you know, good, valuable, well-paying careers in cybersecurity, and we're filling the gap.
That's a wonderful nonprofit, and it's a charitable 501c3.
Yes.
That's great. So it's a tax deduction for our viewers and listeners if you want to help out and give kids a cyber chance. Robert Fernandez, this has been an amazing interview. I'm just curious, where can people go if they need virtual CISO consulting services or need a little help or advice from you?
Yeah, definitely. You can reach out to me either on LinkedIn, look for Robert Fernandez, cybersecurity. I should come up one of the top on the list there. Also, I have the saltedhashsecurity.com is my website. You could reach out to me there as well.
That's wonderful. And you're also the chief information security officer of an amazing broker dealer, the Investment Center, where people have been working there for many years happily. Been in business a long time, doing a great job helping investment advisors get the best products out to their clientele. Folks, you've learned it here first from Robert Fernandez, some of the best practices and things you should do to get to zero trust, to get a better chance, to get one step ahead of the next threat.
You've been listening to Cyber Defense Radio. Stay tuned next time for another amazing and informative episode. CyberDefenseRadio.com is proudly part of the Cyber Defense Media Group, where InfoSec knowledge is power.
Cyber Defense TV and Cyber Defense Radio have launched 24/7/365 live streams. Visit them online today at cyberdefense.tv and cyberdefense.radio. With your host and globally recognized cybersecurity expert, and my good friend, Gary Milewski.